Good. I'm glad you love it, because welcome back to Historians of Movies podcast. I'm your host and I don't know, creator, whatever. I'm Jason Herbert. It's my last name. I'm joined here by Kelsa Pelletier, our guest host for this series, while we're talking about all things Franklin for the next, I don't know how many weeks. We've been talking for like an hour at this point in time, so welcome in to mid-conversation with Jason, Kelsa, and Lindsay. And of course, our this week's guest host, the amazing returning back, Lindsay Chervinsky. Lindsay, welcome back. You want to introduce yourself real fast for people just tuning in?
Sure. I am Lindsay Chervinsky. I'm a presidential historian. I have written a couple of books, including a new one coming out on September 5th called Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic.
Awesome. Thank you. And also, you have an awesome dog.
I do have an awesome dog who hopefully will not punch the door, but no promises.
I think he's interrupted every time you've been on the pod. Like, he has
usually
come up.
Usually.
So if he does, it's a good time. So, all right. So basic idea, same time as last time. Thankfully, we're only doing one episode this time. Last time we had three episodes as Apple launched it. How do you launch a series with 3 hour long episodes? I sat there going, as much as I named a child after Benjamin Franklin, a full on human being. And I was like, Jesus Christ, I need a break. It was a lot for three episodes. First episode, I know they had to get us to Saratoga.
Mm-hmm.
So we had that big turning point. There. So the pacing, right? And so yeah. Forth. But three is a lot. So we're back to a single episode today. So if you're just tuning in, we're going to just talk about some basic ideas here to start before we start spoiling the episode. So if you haven't seen the episode yet, continue to listen and then we'll let you know when we're just going to jump. If you don't know anything about the past or haven't read a book about what comes next, pause. And you know, someone out there is just going, you know, I would like to learn about Ben Franklin, you fucking asshole. But that's okay. So, all right. So this episode, general thoughts, Lindsay, this is your first time joining in. How are you enjoying the series 4 episodes in so far?
Well, so admittedly, I watched all 4 in 2 days, so they're really kind of blending together. So perhaps not the best prep by a guest, for which I apologize. But overall thoughts.
Totally not invited back.
Overall thoughts on the series. So there are things that I really like. One of the more historical elements that I am really enjoying is I think they did a really good job pushing back against eventuality in the mm-hmm. series, because we all sort of know the end point that Franklin succeeds with the French and there's the treaty and he's celebrated and beloved and blah, blah, blah. And so I think they did a really great job in the first couple of episodes of emphasizing in the early days why that was not necessarily guaranteed and reminding us some of the tension and the stress and the difficulty of arranging that challenge. I love the constant pervasiveness of spies. I feel like that is a very accurate and well thought out theme for selling the show, because who doesn't like spycraft? I like, on one hand, I don't always like how dark it is when I'm trying to watch the show and it's bright out and I'm like, I cannot see what is happening. But I feel like especially when they're showing nighttime scenes, it's probably a fairly accurate reflection of what rooms would have felt like. So I appreciate that. The flip side, gosh, sometimes it's dark and I'm like trying to put up the brightness on my computer screen. Mm-hmm. I think that there are probably some inaccuracies which are not particularly, I think they don't detract from the overall arc or narrative, but there are times where I'm like, wait, I need to Google that because I don't think that quite happened. Yep. And I will admit that I am still not totally sure how I feel about Michael Douglas as Benjamin Franklin. I like the look. I feel like aesthetically, this was a very nice choice. I mean, I think Michael Douglas is phenomenal. Jason and I have done an episode on the American president. So obviously, I think he's amazing.
I love that movie. I think it's one of my favorite movies of all time.
So good. I mean, also like Annette Bening. Oh. Legend.
She's beautiful.
And you're gonna say, man, here we go.
Perfect.
We just lost Lindsay. Here we go.
Focus.
Here comes Sydney. Sydney Wade.
Focus.
All right, go ahead.
Benjamin Franklin. So Michael Douglas. So on one hand, like, there are things about him I really like. I like that he occasionally looks very spunky and has, you know, obviously a sense of humor and has some slyness to him. But sometimes I feel like he also talks as though he's Michael Douglas, or talks as though he's President What's-His-Face. I can never remember Andy.
Shepherd.
Thank you, President Shepherd. which I feel like is probably Michael Douglas. So that is the only thing that's occasionally like sort of like sticking for me. But overall, I think he probably does about as well as one could do with Benjamin Franklin as a 21st century human. So those are my overall thoughts. I'm crushed. We planned this long before we knew how exactly the episode structure was going to work. I'm crushed that we didn't get more John Adams in this particular episode. I was optimistic about the casting. The one line that we got is not giving me a lot of hope for the future, but I may be getting ahead of myself. So we will come back to the very last scene.
We're coming to that eventually, because I have questions for you on that one. I was excited about it.
That's a good point, because we're going to talk about this, but like, I generally like that actor in stuff that he's in. When you see him, you know he's done some really powerful, good stuff. You know, I'm just going to say it now. It felt like a little mustache twirling, snidely whiplash-ish, kind of like, and he has to replace you. Like, you know, hi, we're going to spoil the episode now. Go for it. I don't care. Let's just jump in.
Like, I want to comment, but let's go backwards.
So, aesthetically, I really like the choice. I think it was a very good, and obviously they've done some nice makeup to make him a little jowlier, which I don't know is a word, but I'm going to make it one for now. So
he's jowlier. Very first show of, like, image of him, I literally freaked out. I'm like, oh, that's an early portrait of Adams. I like was startled. He looks like 45, 35 year old Adams.
Great choice.
Okay.
Kelsa, Adams doesn't go to replace him, right?
Correct, he doesn't.
So I'm like, wait, I'm not getting my history wrong here.
No, you're not. So, like, I literally gave a paper about this, actually, about what happens after. Literally, that's what I did at the SMH conference this weekend. That's why I'm at a different location at Jamie Goodall's house. Shout out to Jamie Goodall. Go follow her on Twitter. Thank you very much. But, yeah, literally my paper that I was talking about was like, what happens once Adams gets there? So my paper was, it's technically going to be spoiling for next episode, probably. I'm curious how that's going to play out. I have a lot of things to say. But no, Adams doesn't show up there to replace him. He gets sent off. He learns in the, I want to say it's like November, if I'm remembering my paper correctly now. It's been a 2 days and I'm dead inside. He gets appointed to go as another embassy to help Franklin and assist in negotiation, but he's never sent there to replace it. He does find out once he's there that Franklin's already got the treaty done. He ends up showing up like a month after it's been negotiated and done, and like all the final trimmings have been done, you know, T's crossed and everything like that. But he goes there.
As an aside note,
yeah.
Why did early Americans think it was a good idea to send three people to negotiate shit? They do this all the time. They do this from like 1775 up through, you know, like the 1830s. And I get the concept. I do understand the overall concept. If someone gets sick, there's not modern medicine, blah, blah, blah. You want to make it seem more serious. There's a redundancy.
Right, sure.
You are having a more optimistic view than me, because I personally think it's to hold people accountable because they have just complete mistrust in everybody because of the different regional interests. I view it more as like, again,
like a checks and balances situation. Kind
of, but it's mostly because they just don't trust anybody. Because, like,
okay.
And I can get it to a degree. I do learn for a little bit. Like, and this is something that I teased down in my paper. So I'm like, I'm talking about myself right now. And I don't mean to. But, like, you know, just this. Go. Adams comes from such a Puritan background. Yeah. Of course, he's coming more with mistrust. Boston has suffered the most in everything leading up to the war. The majority of people that make up the Continental Army are from the Boston, Massachusetts militia. I forget what version, but like I want to say it's like 80% of them end up joining, becoming like making up the final like Continental Army under George Washington. Like they put the most effort and pain and suffering throughout the war. There's a lot more animosity there. They have more of a desire to make sure their voices are heard. So, of course, they send Adams, who's the most fucking vocal of all of them, as you well know. And I have my own opinions about that. Anyway, but like, even going up to that time, everything that I've read about, like, why is it always a couple of people, even into like the late, mid-1840s for negotiating shit? In my opinion, it always comes down to politicking, specifically for regional interests.
Totally makes sense. Yeah. Totally buy that. I think that's totally legitimate. Yeah. And it also like coincides with after the Civil War, then you have a shift towards one. But exactly. it just
It's because so they don't like it, because everyone doesn't like to say it. It's like, it's not always it's sexualism. So stuff. I'm like, no, but it is sexualism, but it's not like North South. It's New England. Yeah. It's the West. It's the American South. It's American Southwest even is starting to like, quote unquote, be occurring because like Tennessee is a whole different region of Western Pennsylvania. So like, I personally would argue that I love your idea. It's actually more like uplifting on that concept. Like, oh, let's think about like if people get sick and shit like that. But like, I definitely think it's more of like people are angry and more mistrust is between all of them. And at the end of the day, whether people like it or not, Puritans are anti-Catholic. No one likes a Catholic French martyr. Like,
it just seems like, I mean, yes, I think this is all true. It's just they're setting themselves up for so many clusterfucks. Mm-hmm. And it's not surprising that that's what they get. Anyway, I derailed us. The end scene,
this is on brand because I've been dying to be like, hold on, I have opinions on that too. Perfect question because I love that one. I was like, oh my God, I have opinions.
Should we let you talk, Jason, or should we just keep steamrolling you?
Jason lives for this shit. He's like, let's go. Oh, I actually had a question for you. So out of curiosity, just for the context of like people watching the show, what is John Adams doing at this time before he gets to France?
So, Jason, you don't get to talk, apparently. Okay, great. Okay, so context
Florida.
Context for John Adams. So John Adams first rises, a little bit of backstory. John Adams really first rises into national prominence when he defends the British soldiers in the Boston Massacre.
My favorite thing he does, honestly.
It's up there. Well, it's so on brand because John Adams loves to be unpopular if it means he's doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And it's the first big instance in which he really welcomes the unpopularity for a principle, which is that he wanted the revolution to be one of principles and not of passions. Correct. So he defends the Boston Massacre. At some point he was sent to the First and Second Continental Congress as a delegate from Massachusetts with his cousin Samuel Adams and some others. He becomes a leading voice for independence early and often. He was completely indefatigable. How do you pronounce that word? Indefatigable? I can never say it.
I can't either. And I was wondering.
He has endless energy. Let's say that. Yes. He was on
10-20. Let's be honest. That's John Adams.
Yeah, he was on, I think, more committees in Congress than anyone else, and just like constantly was also like the person doing all the notes and the person doing all the drafts.
Yeah, it was him, George Washington, and Madison, and Hamilton. I think Hamilton wasn't there. I think it was him, George Washington, and Madison like were up there on the most committees. I think Adams was the most. I think that's right.
It's not surprising. He really couldn't help himself.
Yeah.
And one of his most important early contributions is he comes up with what is called the Model Treaty. So it's basically a treaty to guide future diplomatic negotiations as the nation is new. It has to start to figure out its international relations. And so he says, like, here's what a treaty generally should look like. And that treaty was then used as the template for many of the ones that followed.
Mm-hmm.
When he is sent to France, he is sent to France to join Franklin, not to replace Franklin, to help with French negotiations. Mm-hmm. I know I will be getting ahead of myself, but I have lots of thoughts about like the general depiction of John Adams and why he is depicted the way he is depicted. But it drives me to this day. It drives me, the number of people who I talk to about, like, I will say I'm writing a book on John Adams, they say, oh, he's just so grouchy. No, he wasn't. This is Jefferson propaganda. No, he wasn't. Like, yes, he could be a curmudgeon, but he also had real joy. He had a sense of humor. He loved people. He loved his wife. He loved his children. He had a sense of humor about himself. My favorite joke of all time that he made was when the election of 1800, he was accused of sending Charles Cotesworth Pinckney to England to pick out four mistresses, two for each of them. And he said, well, where are mine? He must have kept all of them. Like, he's great.
I've never heard that, and that's amazing.
Yeah, he's like, he must have kept them all for himself. Where are mine? So I think that so much of the depiction of him in so many things, so spoiler alert, I intentionally did not let myself watch the John Adams miniseries in like the last decade because I wanted it to not color my writing experience, but I'm going to be binge watching it this summer. But as I recall, even
you've heard Jason.
There's only a reason for you to binge watch that, Lindsay.
We've discussed it.
No, I can see why you wouldn't want to do that. I get it. It's a different level of this is work, and it's going to color my opinion of how other people have depicted him. I get it.
Yeah. But as I recall, even the great Paul Giamatti did occasionally picture him as more grouchy than I think he was. So that mm-hmm. was my rant about John Adams' grouchiness.
Mm-hmm. No, honestly, that's valid. Because ironically enough, I was one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, what's your opinion on the casting, considering how limited of a view we get of him at the end? Because, like, it's like my thing for Franklin. To me, that's Tom Wilkinson. To me, John Adams is Paul Giamatti. You know, like, they do the best. That series, the casting is just, like, the perfect images in my mind of the early, that founding generation.
Spectacular.
You know, like, yeah. Whoever that was, like, gold star to everything you do in your life, that was a perfect series. And
Laura Linney as Abigail was just...
She was amazing.
Yes.
Just literally perfect casting. But, that is something that I was interested in. It was just, like, kind of like what Jason said, like, the twirling mustache thing. I'm like, yeah, he comes off, like, super fucking hostile. And he's not hostile to Franklin.
Initially.
In that way. I would argue he can get hostile to Franklin. More in the written rhetoric. I feel like you're the expert on John Adams. What I read about is mostly him, like, talking shit. He had vicious rhetoric. Like, let's be honest with himself.
He knew how to use
better
pen.
Than him. The only person better than him at vicious rhetoric is Abigail Adams. That was my entire conference paper.
That's like, true.
She fucking. I need to send it to you, Lindsay, because, like, the shit she says about Franklin, fucking savage. Like,
yep.
I got everyone going, like, damn, in the conference. It was great.
Yeah.
Like, nope. It was so fascinating watching how, like, aggressive Adams is portrayed at the very end towards Franklin. Franklin's like, what the fuck? I mean, like, it was just so, like, okay, you're coming with a very specific view of Adams to paint the rest of the series, probably, which I'm not looking forward to, personally, now. Although, again, like, it startled me. He looked like 45, 30-year-old Adams when he, like, showed up there. It was, like, it kind of, I did a bit of a double take there. But, yeah.
Yeah. No, I thought physically it's perfect. I agree with you that it was super aggressive to begin with. And I always felt like the depiction was, the way that their period of time in France is written, I think is a little bit, on one hand, I think is totally accurate. Because, like, Adams and the French don't work.
Correct.
Adams and the French don't work. They just don't. And
literally diametrically opposed in a lot of ways.
In, like, every way.
Hamilton play. Like, they really are.
Yeah. And you know, like, so Franklin really, I think, understood. There's that line, can't remember what episode it was now, where he said, like, sin is tolerated, but ridicule is not.
Oh, yes.
Where, like, and his grandson has the pamphlet.
Yeah.
So he has, like, a very clear sense of the French culture in a way that Adams never gets. But that doesn't mean that Adams is not good at diplomacy. It means that he's much better suited. Like, he kills it when he's at The Hague. Like, the Dutch and Adams are great. And even to a certain extent, Adams
it's just from the French. Yeah.
Yeah. And Adams and the British actually do okay, too, because, like, the British appreciate his honesty and sort of straightforwardness and hardworking nature. It's just Adams and the French don't work.
I have a genuine question. So this is, again, jumping ahead a little bit, just but for my context, since I have you here. A couple of things I've read about with Adams when he is in England as the ambassador to England, once the new constitution is, or the Articles of Confederation are still going on and everything. Like, he talks about getting slighted and stuff at court and everything, but, like, he takes it all, like, on the cheek and is just like, no, I'm still here. And, like, over time has, like, a pretty good relationship with people at court, and his wife does too. And it's really, like, it's admirable in a lot of ways. Because in my opinion, again, I fully agree with you. Adams is shit in France, does great in the Netherlands and at the Hague, depending on if you're a Europeanist or American, however you want to pronounce that. Don't come for me in the comments, please, guys. But when he's in England, he does a great job too. And it's literally just, it does not work in France. He does not get the culture of way of things. And also, I won't lie, I can kind of get it though. Boston, his home colony, his home for everything for generations, has been at the seat of all the pain and suffering for the war the majority of the time and leading up to. I get it that he's impatient. I get it to a degree. It's not coming from a place of cruelty and just some of it, I think he does believe that Franklin's a little incompetent. But again, culture difference. But, like, in some ways, it's like, no, I get it. You're angry. You want things done. You want your country, your country and your state to not be suffering anymore. So it's respectable down the road. So I get that.
I think it also, some of it is like, he was technically a Congregationalist, which is the Puritan descendant, but the Puritan work ethic and the Puritan morality drove him crazy in France because, you know, they start the day late and they end the day late. And there's a lot of activity that doesn't look on its surface like it's work, but it's relationship building in a way that was essential. But he felt it was just like, you know, pandering and socializing and being in a way that he didn't totally understand that work ethic. And so I think that's why The Hague and London worked better, which is not to say that like he achieved a whole lot in London, but I think that was mostly attributable to the Articles of Confederation, the fact that Congress couldn't do anything. He was really hamstrung there. Jason, should we let you talk? Would you like to say a few words?
Sorry, Jason.
Hi.
Hi.
No, all right, no, this is the anti-Craig. No, so I actually want to go back to the beginning of the episode. One of the things I'm interested in here is popular perceptions of both Franklin and Adams as these revolutionaries. I think in many minds, we always associate them as revolutionaries, as, you know, these founders of the Republic and all that. And for me, what I find interesting, and this is something that I don't know, so I'm very much interested to hear both of your perspectives on, say, Franklin and Adams and maybe some of these other guys, is, you know, there is a moment in time. You know, I talk a lot about, say, Seven Years' War. These colonists are proud Brits. They're proudly part of the empire. This is at the crux of the relationship in some ways about the distrust between these colonies and the French because we were just fighting you a decade earlier and so forth. And we see opening up on this in this episode, we see, I guess, 1770, 1771-ish, Franklin is there trying to have the royal governor removed. And instead, it is Franklin himself who is removed from his position. Mm-hmm. So the question I have for the two of you is how we have, say, let's go with, say, Franklin and Adams. To put this in mind, what are these moments, these points of no returns when these men and women, in the case of, say, Abigail, right, look at this and say, enough is enough. There is no going back. And so much we saw that in the negotiations between Franklin and his counterparts in this episode. It's like, no, you don't understand. We're done here, right? In Franklin's mind, there's no going back. So my point is that, my question is this. How do we get here before Franklin, before we're able to get these treaties? When in the minds of, say, Franklin and Adams is enough enough? When do they make that turn? Or I'm now an American.
Okay. I would like, if Lindsay's comfortable with this, her starting, because I would argue that the change comes sooner for Adams compared to Franklin. Because I can almost tell you exactly when it is for Franklin. It's in 1774. And I guarantee you it comes earlier for Adams.
Yeah, it does. But I think what's really interesting is that, like, I think it's actually much harder to pinpoint one moment for Adams, because I think it was so much more of a slow boil. And that was partly because of the Boston context of so much of it is layered into the Hutchinson royal governor stuff. So much of it is layered into, of course, Boston being the seat of revolutionary fervor, the Intolerable Acts. But I think also, Boston and I think Massachusetts more broadly was really one of the colonies that had most flourished under benign neglect, which was the concept of, for those who aren't familiar with that term, basically like, they were left alone by the king for most of their history to just flourish. And they did. And they took, because it was not a super hierarchical society, like, say, a South Carolina type of place, they had town meetings. It was not democratic like we would think of democracy, but it was relatively democratic in that there was a lot of public participation in local governance and a real pride in the inheritors of that sort of British tradition, or they thought of themselves as the inheritors. So I think the slights really built over time. I don't think there was ever, and maybe other people would disagree, and certainly other people have spent more time with early Adams than I have, but I don't think there was ever like one moment. I mean, it was certainly clear by the Boston Massacre where he stood. And it was also certainly clear that his cousin, Samuel Adams, was farther advanced in that and more radical than he was. So I think we can certainly say by Boston Massacre, he's absolutely drawn a line. But it was, I think, a slow build, much like many of the people in Boston had that experience.
I actually fully agree with that for Adams personally, because like, again, there is no slow build for Franklin, on the complete opposite. So quick Kelsa Franklin rant, because there's a lot that's wrong with that scene that they open up with the Privy Council thing, and I would like to point those out. First off, in the context of that scene, yes, it is the cockpit, that's what that's called. Yes, this is in front of the Privy Council, where the man's name escapes me offhand, who is the one that's doing the most of the speaking and dragging Franklin and stuff. He's bringing up the royal governor situation, and then also like encouraging him of being like this person doing all these anonymous pamphlet editorials, calling for sedition basically against Franklin. That's not what happens in that event. The whole thing about trying to get the proprietorship of Pennsylvania to then become a royal colony is the reason originally he is sent to England. He's there for nearly 15 years. Over time, he does become the like more senior advisor to other colonial agents from those others that were mentioned. So he has the most lead because he's there the longest. He can guide them more. So they defer to him when it comes to negotiating rights and responsibilities for all these other colonies that are there. But what ends up happening for him to be dragged before the Privy Council like that is because of the Hutchinson letter affair, where a private incident where Thomas Hutchinson writes about basically making fun of and assaulting the honor of the colonists in a lot of ways from the language that he's using. Craig is probably pissing his pants right now listening to this podcast in the future. But like, he's literally dragging them and saying like all these things like, the fact that we've given them more rights and privileges to vote and things is like detrimental because now they're questioning everything. They need to go back to being lowly serfs and submissive, basically, is the language that he's using. Like this, they need to go back to being deferential, not challenging or even questioning authority. And Franklin gets a hold of this letter, privately exchanges it to people. And from what I know of how it happens, he does intend for this to get in the hands of Sam Adams, because he sends that to his friend who's friends with Sam Adams and the Sons of Liberty, and then it gets printed out and exchanged it everywhere, and then Hutchinson's life is at stake and everything like this, and it's a whole thing. It Lindsay knows this. It's a whole smattering of another point of where the colonies, not necessarily united, but are at least have a more common enemy, contributing to this colonial tension with the empire, more of the breakdown of empires happening with here. And the only reason Franklin addresses that it was him who fucked up and did this, and when it gets out and everything happens, because the biggest thing that came about this was everyone at this time has this thing, and it's a different concept of honor, of a whole gentlemanly gentility shit, where you could exchange private letters and talk shit about each other, but you never let it get public, and you always gave them back. It was this very weird side conversational thing happening, but it was always meant to be in this closed space, and it never got out. But Franklin doing that, like, offended the honor of the people that it hurt, despite the fact that it was fine that it was shared with other people. And the reason why he comes out to, he admits that it was him, is because the honor of two other gentlemen come up to accuse the other for it happening, and a duel happens. And to stop two men from killing each other in a duel, Franklin intervenes and says, no, it was not the fault of either of these people, of you accusing the other, it was me. Goes before the Privy Council. That man in the Privy Council drags Franklin for this. Franklin does not talk back, by the way. That's something they point out. And the lines he's quoting is from a letter that he had years prior, I want to say it's in 72, 73, he articulates, to try to like protect the China vase of the British Empire. It's not like access to the Orient. It's actually where you can sell all the Oriental goods, is to North America. I want to say it's in 1773. I think it's specifically from a letter where he talks about the concept of, quote unquote, no, you need to work with the colonists in North America. Like, there's so much money to be made. They're naturally going to expand and grow in natural populace and not naturally reproduce so fast. Like, it's going to be a huge market to take advantage of. You need to be lenient with them because you can just make so much money off the colonies. So that's from the language he's using. That's from an earlier letter. But he actually never speaks, according to what is said from witnesses there. Franklin sits there, is dragged for like hours. I couldn't even tell. It's more than hours, less than six. It's somewhere in between. He just sits there, is berated and dragged. His personal honor, his character is attacked for letting these private letters slipped out into quote unquote the public sphere, getting exchanged with the colonies, inciting more insurrectionist energy and seditious like activity. And he's completely dragged and his reputation is broken. And because of how they treated him, he says, I am done with the British Empire. That is the moment he goes, no. He has never wanted the empire to break and fracture. His entire life was dedicated to the prosperity and expansion of the empire. And while he even at times wasn't necessarily a colonist guy of the stamp back situation for a fact, he's like, well, no, they can afford to do that. But when he learns like people, even like, I think it's one of his nephews at one point, he gets them a job to be a stamp collector and he learns like what's happening to stamp collectors and everything. He quickly backpedals like, no. I see y'all's point. My bad. But we still don't need to squabble and have this breakdown in empire. So it's in It's early 1774, I want to say. That happens. He's dragged, completely disillusioned, heartbroken almost, I would say. And everything, every bit of goodwill he has ever had is gone with the empire at that point. And that's why I find the title of the fourth episode, A Small Revenge, very fitting, because that outfit that he wears at the end of making the treaty with France, spoilers, guys, for those who are just now catching in, it's suggesting the one that he wore when he got dragged. And also, it's a throwback to one of my favorite portraits of Franklin, by the way, the one where he's like, quote unquote, a man of the
enslaved. This one? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the same blue and everything. And it's one of the ones that I have. In that particular painting, it's showing him being emblematic of the Enlightenment. He's wearing the British royal blue, the nice gold buttons. There's a picture of, is it Socrates or Aristotle? No, Sir Isaac Newton, I think. Was that it? It's one of those guys, like looking down and all the books and things. And it's meant to all like reflect that, which is another like interesting, like little like Easter egg of like, all those things that he did toward that Franklin's known for was to help support the British Empire. And this is something I talked about in the last episode or last podcast is like the most important thing that Franklin does for the United States is what he does in France. It's also like a throwback to all these things and successful things I did for the empire. Doesn't matter. I'm not wearing this for this moment. And it's really, really interesting. Like these little Easter eggs that they're dropping. So they get that whole scene wrong. In a lot of sense, but the fact that how like they attack him publicly, they drag his honor and his character when he's done nothing for the empire, that breakup moment still is very, very good. And I like it for that reason. There's a lot wrong with it, but again, I get why they changed it for the sake of simplifying. But I had a lot to say about that opening scene. Thank you for humoring me there. So.
I want to ask you guys actually about a point of no return for the colonies themselves. For those who are not familiar, there was famously an olive branch petition, 1775. This war was, in a lot of ways, the colonies tried to stave off this war, did not want this. And again, Lindsay, you talked a little bit early on about one of the great things this series does is push back against the idea of inevitability, right? There's so much contingency here. There is, you know, even this episode, I think, was far better than the first three in painting an idea that this might not happen. This is incredibly unlikely. Yeah. I keep thinking about this in terms of like the MCU. I'm like, in what timeline does this actually occur? And we actually in the United States actually forms because of their ability to forge these relationships, right? Kelsey, you were saying last week, you know, we the United States wins this war because it's able to diplomatically because it's able to forge these relationships. So. I'm kind of wondering, Lindsay, Kelsa, if like you could kind of talk a little bit about the own pushback of the colonies to what was their moment of no? Is there a moment also of no return on the part of the colonies as well?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard to say because I think the moment probably is different depending on the colony.
Yeah,
I mean, sure. So you know, I always kind of chuckle at the olive branch petition because it was written after the war had been going for 3 months.
Yeah.
Right.
So for context, we're recording this on April 21st. And we just had the anniversary of the Battle of Lexington and Concord, in which the British forces in Britain marched west to seize ammunition that was in Lexington and Concord. And so like it's pretty hard to have an olive branch petition when you're like, whoops, kind of already started the war.
Yeah.
Sorry, so you know, I think that the olive branch petition was a turning point for whoopsies.
Whoopsies.
Shot them all the way back to the ocean.
So you know, I think the olive branch
Yeah, not just once, but a lot of times.
We kept shooting.
So I think that, you know, the olive branch was, yeah, exactly. It's like you actually kept doing it, kept killing them. And then there was another one. There was the, you know, Battle of Bunker Hill, and, you know, like, it just kind of kept happening. So I think that the olive branch tradition was like the last turning point of sort of the holdouts that were hopeful that if they were explicitly speaking to the king, that he would come to their aid. And when he very much did not, that was, I think, a big turning point for last holdouts. Obviously, a number of colonies, particularly Massachusetts, but I would say most of Virginia as well. Virginia was pretty far out there with Massachusetts, mm-hmm. were by that point ready to go because they were already thinking in these terms. And we should remember that there were, gosh, there was a really good article about this. Now I can't remember. There were a lot of actual tea parties. It wasn't just Boston. Yeah, a lot of, like, other states.
There's like 9 or 10 others, right?
Yeah, there were a lot of other states that dumped tea into their respective harbors and as a protest symbol. And so, you know, when I think about like what was a turning point, I think it is possible that had the empire backed down after the intolerable or the coercive acts, mm-hmm. that it still could have been salvaged. Because there hadn't really been a whole lot of explicit violence. I think after the explicit violence of Lexington and Concord, I don't really see a way out.
Yeah. I'm kind of there with Lindsay. For me, it's Lexington and Concord is clearly like it's a civil war for me. Like, again, breakdown of empire. Like, to me, like, this is such a grad school answer to me. Like, that's the breakdown of the empire, but it's not revolution yet. And because of what's happening so much, just, again, I keep going back to this thing, like, so much of it's specifically affecting Massachusetts. I'd say, like, for the revolution ideas and, like, the move towards revolutions happening first in Massachusetts, maybe, because there's more organization about it. It's the long-term things that Lindsay's already very accurately talked about and stuff. But I'd say as a whole of the colonies, if we're getting specific, if we're going, I would argue it's before the Declaration of Independence, probably, like, I want to say it's October, September of 1775. And the reason why I'm picking that date is because that is where the Secret Committee of Correspondence is made, which Benjamin Franklin was part of. It's basically the first, like, version of our Office of Foreign Affairs, and, like, the CIA, like, origin story is from this. So at that point, you've already got delegates that have been sent to the Second Continental Congress that have been chosen by all the colonies for their representation. They've all decided to make this. And already separately, there's, fun fact, at this point, there's already been a quote-unquote Frenchman who has spoken to them quietly in under the cover of night in a, like, outside of a tavern or whatever in Philadelphia, talking to Franklin and a couple of other guys, like, feeling out if France would work with them. That's one of the reasons they motivate them to send Silas Deane later, who goes actually before Franklin to France, because of this. So I would argue the moment, like, where there's no going back for the Americans is where they decide to make basically a secret committee to deal in espionage, specifically to filter out what other foreign countries will work with us before we declare independence. And for me, that's very specific. While it's not the public Declaration of Independence and we're publishing it and everything, but if you get into the weeds of all the shit, because after the Seven Years' War, France for a long time under Louis the 15th actually had, like, French foreign agents coming in and out, and a lot of them were actually in Boston, Massachusetts, like, kind of seeing where tension would be. Around the Stamp Act, they're not there that much, but there's always somebody there kind of writing back, like, what's going on, especially after they've heard what's going on with the Stamp Act and everything like that. But because of what happens in the Boston Tea Party, that is such a glowing point of England can no longer control their colonies. Oh, let's pay attention a bit more.
Well, that's also a really good point, because
it's that point where it's kind of like the delegates have now decided, let's start seeking out foreign aid before they declare independence. For me, that's like, you kind of can't stop the steamroll of independence. Not to be into my campaign with common sense, that helps, but, like, the delegates are making moves, in my opinion. So,
yeah, well, I mean, I always kind of, I always think of the Declaration of Independence as being like that's obviously the preamble is an exquisite work of art, but it actually has much more impact for later revolutions than it does for the American.
Oh, absolutely. Revolution. I teach it that way. Absolutely. Yeah. It's already been predetermined. There's a reason why they've decided to move forward with it. It's just
yeah, but so I think that like the concept of declaring independence and the way that it is phrased is actually a recognition of what it means to be independent, which means that you have to have recognition by other states in order for your existence to be a lived reality. And so what you're talking about in terms of trying to think about how to start working with other nations is trying to actually embody one of the key things that a sovereign nation does, which is to interact with other sovereign nations.
Exactly.
That's a really interesting point.
Exactly. So yeah, for me, that's
what do you think,
just because like the broader perspective is what I tend to look at. But I mean, honestly, like if we're going like which colony decided to become a, you know, which state decided to be first, obviously it's Massachusetts. But as a whole, I'd say probably like winter 1775 is probably where they'd say they basically won independence, but they haven't convinced enough people yet.
What do you think, Jason?
I think the thing I always find fascinating, of course, you know, I studied the South, right, is how, again, sitting here 250 years later, we think of the United States as the United States, and that simply was not the case. So people coming to this time period for the very first time, maybe watching the series, reading some of these amazing books that are talked about, Lindsay Shores included, obviously, right, is how fractious these colonies actually were. I specifically look at the South so many times, think, how did this ever happen? How did we ever come together? Because the things that the South had nothing in common with these Northern colonies. So I'm always shocked. And of course, look, East and West Florida do not rebel. You know, these are also colonies. We always forget about these two colonies. So there's your Florida moment. What the Florida, brought to you by Jason. But that's what I always find fascinating is the fact that these things come together, especially even as the war goes. It's like, you know, these it feels as though, you know, into the war itself, okay, maybe the Northern colonies will continue to secede, but maybe the British Empire can hold on in the South. And that obviously doesn't happen either. One of the questions that I had watching this, Lindsay, and you kind of brought this up early on, was this idea of espionage, of spycraft. And it seems to me that everyone in the world understands that Benjamin Franklin is the linchpin to this whole operation, whether or not it's going to succeed. So why not assassinate the man? Are there no attempts, Kelsa, on Franklin's life? I keep wondering, if he's so dangerous, why not kill him?
Okay, so I have my opinions on this. That's a whole, how dare you, because someone's now going to beat me to it. That's a whole separate thing that I want to work on. There's one article that's out there that talks about how a woman almost poisoned him, basically, supposedly, maybe kind of, sort of. It's this very weird article, and now the name of it escapes me. But basically, there's this woman, for context real quick, while Franklin is in France, so many Americans and people who are British who leave Britain and everything and like still like appeal for his help and everything while he's there, even before like they're officially recognized as the United States and everything. People are constantly going to him like letter of rec. There's the running joke that he has like a joking one made that he just signs that he has to be made that they don't get to see by the time they, like a Frenchman wants to go to America, you know. Supposedly that he does that, and other people are reaching out to him like for a financial assistance, like, I've been robbed, I'm an American, I'm here to help the American cause, I've been robbed, I no longer can afford the place that I am, is there a way I can get an advance loan payment? Weird little things like this constantly. At one point, supposedly, it's been a long time since I've read this article, so bear with me, listeners. Basically, this woman, if I'm remembering correctly, was the wife to a man that knew Franklin, and then he left her pregnant or with a newborn baby, I don't remember which, and appealed for him for help, and apparently he helped her, and then came back for more help, and he's like, I've already given you what I can help you with. And somehow along the way, someone else meets her, she bitches about what Franklin not helping her, and somehow she has this substance that is then led to believe is a type of poison that her husband used to use to get high or something. And the way that it's told in this article, again, it's been a long time since I've read this, okay, is that this man then writes to warn Franklin, worried that this woman might try to poison him basically with this white powder that she has. And I believe she actually ends up getting thrown in jail because they're like worried that she's going to try to kill him. It's a whole weird what if thing that happens. Yes, like this is a thing. It's been, I wish I could remember the name of the article. I actually didn't think about this. But that's the other thing is, I'd have to do more research into this, but it's always kind of been my thing too. Like, why aren't they killing him? And point blank, I think they wouldn't, because they know at that point, if they were to kill him intentionally, there would be no way of convincing them to acquiesce and allow autonomy in the colonies but still be part of the British Empire. I think they're always like holding out that they can convince and wear them down to just accept autonomy and not independence. But killing Franklin would, I think, be really publicly damning to them, and especially not in the eyes of the French, by the way, in the eyes of British people in England. Because Franklin still, the whole time he's in France, is writing to a lot of his British contacts. There's a whole separate thing that I want to do with another chapter with him and his friendship with David Hartley, who's a member of the House of Commons. Yeah, House of Commons, who's one of those people the entire time during the war, even beforehand, is like, no, we need to listen to what the colonists are saying. We don't want them to separate. We don't want this war. He's one of those people the whole time who is advocating in Parliament, like, no, we need to end this war. We need to bring them back into the British Empire. We should not be neglecting these other Englishmen, right? And the whole time. Otherwise, though, he's writing Franklin, like, these whole separate things, like, you know, to acquiesce, trading of POWs, a whole different language of honor is happening there. Again, Craig Bruce Smith is excited as hell listening to this portion of the podcast. But with all of that happening, Franklin was loved and respected in England. Again, everything up until this point is he benefited the British Empire. He is a symbol of Britain, all of his old exploits. Point fucking blank. Man fucking discovers electricity. The man was influential with like the social life of England, representing the interests in the American colonies. He was tied into all these philosophical and royal societies, tied into the rest of Europe because of the Royal Society. Like, the man was loved by people in England. I think it would have been like, and again, this is like just me spitballing here, but I think it would have been the worst PR moment to have killed Franklin for England. At that point, I think it would have been horrible PR move. Especially also if they tried to do that, even though it's happening in France, to try to assassinate somebody in France who is so public in France, whether the French government likes it or not. I think they would have also taken that as an act of war. And they don't want to get France to fight this war as long as possible, because that's multiple fronts at that point. It's not just North America. That's across the channel. That's in the fucking West Indies. That's in other places in Indochina, like areas and other parts. It's a multi-front global war again if they are to offend France still. So that's my opinion, my educated opinion about why there's no quote-unquote like organized assassination attempts on Franklin. It would have been too bad. It genuinely would have been just too bad. Because again, like in Parliament the whole time, a lot of people don't like to talk about this is, they assume that once the war starts, like the people who are like trying to end the war is a small voice in Parliament. Not really. Like, they're pretty fucking vocal. It's not like a fringe group. It's not half, but it's not a fringe amount that's saying like we don't want a war with the colonies, even during the war. So I genuinely think it's, to put it short, it's nothing that they wanted to do. If there was considerations for it, I have to do research into it. I don't know. But I genuinely think that was just been a horrible decision. It's literally shooting themselves in the foot about like the end. It's almost like this prolific thing of like, well, there's the end of the British Empire and all of our success that was so symbolized in a figure that's so public. So
I think also, so, you know, I think it would have been a PR catastrophe. It would have made him into a martyr, which would have been very unbeneficial.
Correct.
But I think that also, even though, you know, he wasn't recognized initially as an ambassador, there was a set of laws law of nations. There were international rules governing trade and diplomacy, and you know, like for example, in 1799, when John Adams sends his new peace commission to go treat with France, they basically say that, you know, they give extremely broad discretion, but they say like it cannot abridge the law of nations.
Yep.
And one of the big concerns early on in his presidency was the insult paid to the ministers of the United States was an insult to American sovereignty. And if there was physical insult, if they were attacked, if they were assaulted in some way, that was a declaration of war. And yeah. So while I don't think anyone was willing to necessarily, I don't think that anyone was necessarily willing to accord Franklin that quite that status. I think there were unspoken rules, which, I mean, we still to a certain extent have today. If we look at the news, you know, there was a huge 60 Minutes story about the new conclusions about the attacks on soldiers and foreign agents by probably this Russian force used microwave technology basically to cause brain injury. And the reason that is an outrage is because there is still a certain level of respect for foreign actors on foreign soil if they're operating in a diplomatic capacity.
And building off of that, that's also one of the things that I love that's depicted in the series is the scenes with Lord Stormont going to Vergennes. Like, why are you entertaining or not going out of your way to shut down this American? Because it's proportional response thing.
It's a sign of disrespect. Yeah,
exactly. It's a sign of disrespect. It's against the law of nations. I represent the King of England. You know, we are at war with our colonists. You should not be entertaining him. That is an act of aggression. Look as though you are aiding and abetting an enemy of my country, which I'm trying to coalesce back to being a submissive. And you're entertaining this? That's, again, exactly what Lindsay said, like the law of nations. Elijah Gold's book is like everything in my brain right now about treaty worthiness. Everyone should read that book.
I actually want to move on actually to this idea of, because there's a moment here. First of all, it's really interesting to watch a Louis XVI with a head. I found that that's been an uncommon depiction of him in American media. So that's kind of neat. There are a couple of things going on with Louis, and I actually want to talk about them as his final big point talk about this episode. First of all, one of the things I really enjoy is seeing how young a lot of these actors on this stage really are. Louis is not particularly an old, he's not at all. We see in the first three episodes, he's very reluctant, very almost dismissive of the American cause, quite little, does not want to go down the route of like Louis, his predecessor lost Canada. Right.
Yep.
And a lot of these guys are concerned with their legacy. There's an understanding we're going to be back at war with England at some point in time, but when and where and so forth. At the same time, he seems to also flip on this episode. So much of this episode, as we're talking about today, seems to be these decision points. When Louis says, okay, it just felt like I thought maybe perhaps this series was going to draw out this march to French engagement with the colonies. We're episode 4, and Louis's like, all right, we're in. Let's go. Game on, right? And we conclude this episode, and it's anticlimactic. You're good.
I was waiting for you to say that. For me, it was like it made sense, but I'm like, Jason's gonna hate this.
Sure.
A lot of viewers I was like are like not gonna like this point.
The colonies are not the center of the French center of the French world, right? And that's the other thing that I hope that people are taking away when they study these engagements is that we're talking about a portion of the world, and these guys are looking at global colonies. This is only a slice of the world. Yep. So Kelsa, Lindsay, can you maybe kind of talk a little bit about the French perspective? Is they're looking at this at all? What are your thoughts as far as Louis? What's he evident? And ultimately, when he finally gives the go-ahead here, is it Saratoga? Is it something else? What's going on here?
So I think, one of my favorite things about studying John Adams' time abroad is he comes away with this deep conviction that Europeans could not care less about the United States. They are useful. They're interested in the United States so long as it is useful to them in some way, but they do not care. They are not interested. They are far more focused on these centuries old conflicts between the European empires. They're constantly feuding between each other. They're going to make decisions that do not factor in the well-being of the United States, even if the United States is an ally. And that's a really important conviction because it shapes how he thinks about their actions. It shapes how he thinks about how they approach the United States, how they approach diplomacy. It's why he's way less trusting to France than Jefferson is later on, because he's like, no. There's no benevolent interest in, you know, in like looking out for them as like a fairy godmother. That is not happening. Absolutely. And so that's very much true in the revolutionary context, because they saw Europe as the center of the globe, and there were different offshoots. There were the North American colonies, which they were interested in maintaining as a market, not necessarily because they were super rich or valuable for themselves, but as a place to sell goods. Mm-hmm. They were far more interested in the Caribbean because that's where the money was to be made. And Britain was increasingly interested in India and certain parts of Africa as places to export resources. And France, of course, was feuding with them over all of those things.
Yeah.
They were also particularly, what I like about that moment, even though it feels anticlimactic, is we forget now, because even the monarchies that still exist today, they tend to be constitutional monarchies. And so they're very limited. And often the monarchs are very much sort of figureheads or they're heads of state. So they don't have a whole lot of governing role. So perhaps I think an autocrat is almost a better example. But these were total monarchies at the time. They had complete power. And so whatever they said went, especially in France, because it was very much an ancient regime. And so it's actually super accurate to have the king spin on a dime and for that to feel like whiplash and be like, but what? Why? And whatever he said went. And so in some ways, it's actually a super accurate reflection. And it's why they got into so many stupid ass wars, because it was just up to the king's whim. And I'm not saying like just the French king. There were a lot of stupid kings that had a desire to fight and wanted to have glory. And they were concerned about dynastic glory and maintaining the land of their forefathers and not being the king that brought it all down, which unfortunately Louis was.
I fully agree with everything that Lindsay said. And as somebody who, for my MA thesis, I got to read a lot of the like documents that they literally wrote essays back and forth to each other about trying to persuade Maurepas, who's like the equivalent of like the chief of staff to the president under Louis XVI at the time, because he's an old fuck at this point, that's still super respected and everything like this. But literally, Gerald, who shows up in this episode as like the another like he's actually equivalent of like Secretary of the Navy or like Minister of the Navy in France, and then underneath Vergennes, him and Vergennes write a series of essays literally trying to convince Louis XVI to get involved in this war. And Turgot, who is the finance minister at the time, is weird hearing them say like Necker or whatever. It's like he doesn't come till later. Actually, he's like doing something else at the time.
But they also completely erase Silas Deane, who must have, he's rolling over in his grave.
Oh, absolutely. Side note. No, they do. I have a whole a thing. I understand why they do it, because the shit with him and Lee would be too distracting.
Totally.
But also, like, I wanted to watch that bullshit. Like, it would have been very, very funny to watch. But
it's like another series altogether, almost.
That would be PBS. Pick that up. All the bullshit for Silas Deane and the concept of his honor in U.S. history about was he just a war profiteer or not, along with Robert Morris's role in the war. I'm just saying that would be. I'd watch the shit out of that. Let me.
You might be the only one.
I probably am. Yeah. No, Jess will watch
it. Most Americans are going, who?
Oh my God. Anyway,
yeah.
So there's a whole bunch.
Dr. Herbert's taking a nappy nap. So
you actually would find Dean's experience very entertaining, I think, Jason. But yeah, they have a whole bunch of essays that go back and forth trying to convince the king over time. And the thing that they do agree on is, weirdly enough, like they make a joke about this in the thing. They like, why did he? Vergennes like, why did you help? He said he was fine with it as long as he didn't raise taxes. That's good for us. Makes us look good. That's not exactly true. The whole debate between Vergennes and Turgot on the back channels is that Turgot's like, we can never publicly support the United States, even though it would be hugely beneficial to hurt England, because we are too broke. We can give them secret aid, which that means we can have limits and not hard like things of like promises of money to them. So absolutely, let's send them secret aid the entire time as long as they want, because we can be like, it's too obvious, not enough right now, we have other things, because there's no like guarantee of money to be moved. But the whole time, Vergennes, like, yes, he's doing all this back-channeling shit that we're seeing in the show, but he's like actively trying to persuade Louis more than is let on. But the thing that is accurate still is that there was no necessary thing that he would just listen to that. The changing his mind one day thing that Lindsay said is basically kind of what happens. Because the whole time, Louis, my understanding from these documents, it's like, you have to take them with a grain of salt too. Like, they've been edited to then be shared publicly still in a lot of ways down the road, like, you know, archival bias and all these things that you have to keep aware of as a historian. But the concept has always been there. Like, Louis is like, I'm a young king. I don't really know what's going on. Doesn't want to seem like he doesn't know what's going on. My advisors say we can't afford this war, but oh, to get back at the English later after this huge battle, and our people love them. I want my people to love me. Like, that undertone that shows through in the show, accurate, very, very accurate in that little respect. But yeah, definitely anticlimactic. The whole time I'm like, accurate. Just one day deciding he's doing that. The fact that he's taking that long on the same damn lock for like a year and a half, basically, in the timeline of those four episodes is fascinating to me.
I have a sartorial question. Does it surprise either of you that, like, when he's working on his locks, he has white hair and, like, looked a lot younger, and then all of a sudden he's in the receiving room, then has the long hair? Yeah.
It took me a second to recognize him. Exact same. Yeah, I thought to you, I was like, wait, is this Jack Black now? Is what I was. Yeah, it was different.
Was that weird? I can't unsee that now. No, I thought it was weird too. Because also, like, the energy between those different scenes is so drastic too. Like, the energy that him meeting Franklin, to me, is more accurate what I've read about Louis. Yes, he was a weird dude and liked navigation and making things and clocks and stuff. That's all accurate. But the, like, maturity and all the earlier scenes that we've seen of him was weird to me the entire time. And I was just like, okay, like, this came up on the first episode, first podcast. I was like, Craig, was that, like, supposed to be Maripol too young or Louis with a wig? Like, I couldn't tell. It was weird to me from the context and everything. But yeah, no, you're not the only one. I was like, what the hell is this? This is such a deterrent, a distraction, and like, where was this guy the whole time? It was very weird. It was very abrupt. Fully agree with you on that. I did a double take when I saw that in the series.
Yeah, you know, and again, just because that, as listeners are in, and you guys are probably familiar if you're listening in now, we talked a little bit last episode about the speed or lack of speed of communication cross channel. Now you've got to actually create these. You've got to field weapons. You've got to create ships. Just because the French have decided to engage in this war, there's a tremendous amount of time in which the colonies can still lose this very young war as well. And I guess we're going to see that going forward. So that leads me, maybe as we're going to kind of work towards wrapping up here, we started to see a little bit of intrigue regarding Franklin's grandson, some stuff going on. What are we looking forward to? We've already introduced our new villain, John Adams. Wait, he's not a villain.
He is a villain, actually. Depending on who you talk to, he is a villain. But overall, no.
As we move forward here, we're four episodes in this episode. I mean, already four episodes in this episode. I think this series is 10, I think, episodes long or so. Maybe nine, I think. What are we looking forward to happen in the immediate future? If you guys can kind of tell us, hey, as we start to channel in to watch next week, what are you looking for to see what happens next on this series? Kelsa,
well,
do you want to go first?
Well, I think obviously I'm very curious to see.
I was going to have Lindsay is going to fish you going off. Either one, no, I'm not going to tell you what
long.
To do.
I will talk too long. I want Lindsay to go first. I need to be short and succinct like her.
So I am obviously looking forward to seeing how they present John Adams going forward. If they continue this like very aggressive, almost like pirate style portrayal, I'm going to have some real whiplash when I go from that to John Adams in July. John, McCullough John Adams. So I'm looking forward to that. I think that will be really interesting. I think the dynamic will be really interesting. I think one of the problems that they've set up that I think is going to be a challenge is they've set up Franklin to appear to be hardworking. Like, he's repairing his press. He's up late doing that. He's working hard. And so it's going to make the genuine conflict that did exist, the cultural conflict that did exist between Adams and Franklin, I think, kind of appear out of nowhere. The second piece that I'm really interested in is the role of Bancroft, Edward Bancroft, who is the friend, doctor, spy that is in Franklin's household. And this was a figure that I will admit that I was not particularly all that familiar with. And so I have been doing some reading, and some accounts suggest that historians were not really aware of his duplicity until like the 1880s. But Bernard Baylin, who was, you know, like an all-time great in the field, felt like there were times that the letters really suggest that Franklin actually knew what was happening and was sort of using the duplicity intentionally, like feeding either information that would be harmful to the British or intentionally revealing things that to put pressure on the French. So it'll be very interesting to see which take they approach and how they present Franklin's knowledge of that. It almost in this last episode, when the French minister comes or the French spy master comes, and no, when the British spy master comes and meets with Franklin and asks about negotiating, and Franklin says no, but he wants Bancroft there. It almost seemed like they were starting to hint at that. So that's going to be a dynamic that I'm really looking forward to. Also, I want to know which one of the elderly broads he spends more time with. That was not a nice way to say that.
No, it's accurate. It's accurate.
No, well, neither it's of a historical them are elderly. Term, Lindsay. They are lovely. And well, one is lovely. One is the dishwasher woman. Was
the
that
washerwoman or whatever. Washwoman. Okay.
I really like Brion, and she's Thank delightful.
That's the correct
and she
answer.
Yeah.
I was like,
is,
why otherwise?
She is a delightful composer, and she is very talented and sweet. I hope that he spends more time with her.
I'm actually curious how they're going to do that too. I want to answer this and then touch on something before we wrap up, just because like I've been dying to talk about Brion more for this episode. Things I'm looking forward to the most. I fully agree with Lindsay how they're going to portray Bancroft, because one of the things that would have been the catalyst for where that direction would go would be if Arthur Lee and Dean were there, because Arthur Lee was always suspicious of Bancroft the entire time that he was there before they were all recalled and shit. So because you don't have that person to be the catalyst for this whole thing, because that's again, it would have distracted from the Franklin focused narrative. But for listeners who don't know, like, there's a whole like writing campaign between Arthur Lee saying like Franklin's complicit because Bancroft's definitely up to something. Dean's up to something because of all this war profiteering. All of them are actually bad because he's like a huge paranoid guy. Great spy in England. Bad diplomat. Lee was a horrible diplomat. His training by nature made him a bad diplomat. His biographer says so, and I agree with them. So because you don't have Lee, I am like, where are they going to go with the Bancroft angle? Like, for me, I'm like, I'm spoiled by that. I don't know how they get that to go unless he just fucks up somehow. And Franklin, like, gets to be savvy on the no. But there's also this issue because down the road, early on, while in France still, Franklin's writing in defense of Bancroft. So it was on to me that they're showing that, and because again, like, I'm not going to argue with Bernard Baylin. It's Bernard Baylin. And Franklin probably was some awareness, but it is interesting though, like, there's early on, and like, I want to say it's till like 1789, he's like writing in defense of Dean and Bancroft. And I always wondered if he's doing this just to try to keep them from infighting because of the mission that they have at that point, because they still need to seem like a unified front. Or there's something else at play. I don't have the answer there, but fully agree with Lindsay because Lee's not there. How do you go about the Bancroft situation? That's interesting. I am interested to see some stuff with the grandson. I look, that man's a great actor. I'm not interested in Temple's story personally. Mostly because I know what happens to him later. I'm uninterested in him as a human being. Not the actor, but the character. I don't like William Temple Franklin. There, I've said it. What the hell?
Kind of a brat.
Oh no, he gets Lindsay. He's more than a fucking brat down the road. He's a fucking shithead. He's a fucking shithead in real life. And I won't lie. Like, I like that guy as an actor. I don't like he's too baby faced or how in my head how Temple looks or even behaves. Yeah, he's like white behind, like, you know, like what is it, like wet behind the ears a little
wet
bit.
Wet behind the ears.
He's not that. Thank you. Wet behind the ears when he gets to France. He's not that incompetent though. Because he's just like his dad, just like his grandpa. He likes the ladies. So there's a whole thing that happens later. So I just don't like the
hawks on both their houses.
Actually. But the other thing I'm interested is also how they're going to portray Brilion and Helvetius. Because spoiler, no one knows this, but down the road, Franklin does propose to Helvetius the whole time in her salon. Him and Turgot hang out, flirting with her, and he actually proposes to her, and she says, "No, I cannot. I love you. I love my husband, and it would. I do not want to offend his soul in the afterlife, kind of thing. Kind of weird nonsense shit. He always tries to sleep with Brion. She never tries to sleep with him. The angle that they're going is that she's going to try to sleep with him. That's incorrect. Everything that I've read says she will never fucking sleep with him. It's a good, I do for good TV though. I love the dynamic they're setting up for that. It's great TV. It's great TV. But what is also I'm interested in is how it's kind of like, how do they go from here also with the Adams angle? Because one of the reasons that Franklin and Adams come into conflict with each other, yes, it's the French culture shit that I've been saying this whole episode that we're talking, but also the Lee and Bancroft and Dean angle plays into that breakup of a friendship and everything. So it's like, so are you just nipping this in the ass and making just Adams a complete asshole the entire time from the beginning to the end of episode 4? That's not accurate at all, though.
Mm-hmm.
Like, again, like Lindsay said, it's very easy to just make John Adams an asshole and a grouch. I don't like that. So, like, if they do that, that's probably going to be my biggest criticism overall. Like, you can get past, like, certain casting things, because, again, Tom Wilkinson is, to me, Franklin. Douglas definitely is Douglas, but I do like sometimes his portrayal. It's mostly the voice that kind of always reminds me it's Douglas and not Franklin, but I feel like that's also me, Douglas, because I just like Douglas. But, I think moving forward, it's going to literally be, like, how are they going to portray Franklin and Adams's relationship? Especially if he comes in with this haughty toddy attitude and everything. Cause again, like Lindsay knows this, that's not indicative of John Adams. In France, he tries to learn some stuff with France, gets a little butthurt down the road with some of it. And again, becomes this impatient Puritan, which again, understandable. He wants Boston to be safe and doesn't understand the cultural stuff, but he's not coming out guns blazing, being a jerk. So if they do that to John, I'm going to be kind of upset. Like, that will be, in my opinion, like, the biggest, like, this kind of fucking ruins it for me. That will be probably my biggest criticism of that. Again, I don't like John Adams, but that's doing him dirty if they do that.
Jason, what are you looking for?
I have to imagine with an actor with the range of Eddie Marsan, who I've seen a bunch of stuff, and he's, every time, I was saying this earlier, I've always liked his work. I think he's really terrific. I would imagine that what we got was a teaser tonight, or for that episode. I think we're going to get a much more nuanced version of Adams than maybe we're afraid of what we're going to see, just because he's such a talented, capable guy. Even if the character were poorly written, I can't imagine that a guy as talented as he is would not interject, Adams, and I don't know Adams as well as the two of you, right? But Adams is not a single emotion. He's not a single, anything like that. He has a, he is an incredibly nuanced guy himself, right? And maybe that's what we did not see as much of in that Adams series. So hopefully, I don't know. We'll see. That's what I'm looking forward to seeing. Again, I'm not really interested in the Temple storyline. It's the reason why we didn't really talk about it tonight. And frankly, I don't care about Adams' sex life. I see enough of old people and their sex lives in the news right now. So we'll see where this goes. You know?
I hope you edit out that squeal laugh I just made. Jesus.
Unfortunately not.
Oh my God.
That said, we're going to wrap it up here. Lizzie Chervinsky, Casa Pelletieri. See what I got it better this time now. I did the thing with the hand.
I like that you put it more and more with an accent. Honestly, my ancestors are appreciating this. Thank you.
That's good. I don't know. Bene. So, guys, thank you so very much for being here. And, guys, everybody, thank you guys so much for coming in to listen to this podcast, for sharing this with your friends, enemies, and neighbors, sometimes all three. We'll have more stuff for you coming this week. So, any last words, Kelsa? Lindsay?
I'm excited to see where the series is going to go. Thank you for being here, Lindsay.
Huzzah.
That's perfect. All right, guys. Ciao for now.